Tonight, we're continuing our study of Know Why You Believe, and tonight we move into a chapter that deals with a topic that probably, if I were to say, maybe is one of the greatest challenges intellectually to the Christian faith today, it's probably this one, and that is the challenge that modern science presents to the Christian faith. And I think for a lot of people, they're bombarded day after day after day with the tenets and the presuppositions of rationalism, of naturalism, of evolutionism, and so they're just bombarded with it every day, and it's kind of like when you jump into a pool and it's cold, you get swimming for a while and you're kind of used to it after a while. That's kind of how our culture is with naturalism and evolutionism. It's just been around us so much that we've just become accustomed to it. And if we're not careful, we can grow too accustomed to it. But I think this issue presents a challenge to a defense of the Christian faith as well as witnessing to the Christian faith. And so he's going to address that in this chapter number 8. Why should we believe in God in the face of modern science and all that it claims and all of the evidence that it purports to have that says that Christianity is impossible? So why believe in God? He starts out by just reminding us that we today in the modern world have the tendency to fall into a short-sightedness with a very limited scope of history. And we tend to think, and perhaps it's always been this way throughout the history of the world, but we always tend to think that the age in which we live is the most progressive, is the most technologically advanced, is the furthest along in terms of development and where we need to be. And sometimes that can create kind of a pride in comparing our current generation to past generations and thinking that we can't, there's nothing to learn from previous generations and we have all the answers. And I think that's particularly true in our age with technology and science. We see how far we've come in technology and developing that technology, and we think there's really not a whole lot that we can learn from the 1800s and the 1700s. What do they really have to tell us? I mean, we've moved so much far beyond them in our understanding. And so that can present a very narrow view of things, a very, very narrow view of history. And he says, when we consider our present circumstances, we lack a historical horizon to give us perspective. So he's suggesting we need a broader view. We need a larger view of where we fit in the grand scheme of history. And he says, he just reminds us that some of the comforts, most of the comforts really, and conveniences that we use every day, and the ones that we don't even think about because we're just so used to having them, that in the grand scheme of the history of the human race are very, very short, very recent in terms of, you know, just things that we assume. You walk over to the wall and flip the switch that you're going to have a light on. We just assume that. We don't even think about it. We assume we're going to have cool air or hot air in the wintertime in our homes. We assume that our cars are going to go out and start, at least for the most part. But we just kind of get used to having these technologies. We go to the refrigerator and can have refrigerated food at the tip of our fingertips. We can hit a button and we can warm it up in a minute if we need to in the microwave, or a few minutes on the stove. We just have all these and we don't really think about really how short of a time span we've had these conveniences in the history of the world. And so one of the things about this historical short-sightedness is that it can be very detrimental to understanding. And in a couple of ways that he suggests, one of the ways that this historical short-sightedness is detrimental is that whenever we ignore anything beyond our own circumstances, we tend to think that what is now is normal. So in other words, when we have just a tunnel vision, kind of a limited view of things, we kind of see whatever we're doing right now is that's the way it's always been. It's just normal. And so we lose a critical perspective, the ability to look at life and look at our situation through a more critical eye and to evaluate ourselves, to evaluate our thinking, and we lose context. So we lose a broader context of understanding. He also says that when we lose this historical perspective, we tend to think that what is new is always better. So he says we have a tendency when we lose this bigger worldview, this bigger perspective of history, we think that whatever's happening now is normal. And we think that whatever is new has to be better. But he says that's not always the case. Yes, technology does make some things better. Very thankful that we can have cold milk and warm suppers. You know, I'm very thankful that we have medicines and developments in surgery and all of these things that can make our lives better and can extend our lives. But there are always downsides to technology too, right? So the same technology that can be used to heal can be used to destroy. The same technology that can be used for good information, a computer or the internet, can be used for the dissemination of bad information on the computer and the internet. So technology makes some things better, but it also makes some things worse. And so we need to keep that in mind. And so what is now is not always normal, and what is new is not necessarily better. And so we need to keep that in mind, he suggests, as we think about the relationship between Christianity and science. So what are some reasons to believe in God and believe in the Christian faith in the light of modern science? He says, really the purpose of this lesson is to provide a historical perspective on the relationship between science and Christianity, and really to remind us that there hasn't always been this antagonistic relationship between Christianity and science. And you turn on the news, you listen to an opinion program, you read an opinion page in the newspaper, and it's pretty much assumed that science is the enemy of Christianity. That's the world in which we live in right now. That's the waters in which we swim. But it hasn't always been that way. And so he says, for really the large part of the world, there's been a closer, friendly relationship between what we would call science and religion or in faith. And so he just kind of wants us to help us see that perspective. Really, modern science, as we know it, began in the 19th century when science was defined and carried out in a radically different way than it had been before. In fact, the word scientist was not even used, was not even a word until the middle of the 19th century, so mid-1800s. Didn't even use the word scientist. And so in this lesson, we're going to consider a couple of broad reasons for believing in Christianity in the face of modern science. And that is, we're going to look at some historical reasons and then some more foundational reasons. And so let's look at some historical reasons. In its historical context, the relationship of science and Christian belief has been mostly harmonious, not hostile. It used to be that what we would now today call science used to be referred to as natural philosophy or as natural theology in a more Christian context. In other words, it was a way of thinking about the natural world through a philosophical or a theological lens. And so natural philosophy concerned itself with the workings of nature. It sought to discover and utilize the forces and laws of nature for specific purposes, to understand how the world works and to try to improve the quality of life for people. So it was investigating the natural world, but it was doing so through some pretty basic philosophical or theological assumptions and for purposes of gaining knowledge and seeking to help people. So the goal of natural theology or natural philosophy was to connect the workings of the world with the one thing or being that could explain and justify those workings. Now, that's left purposefully broad because in the Greek world, they would connect natural philosophy with their belief in the gods or in this organizing principle. In our Christian worldview, we would just not leave that generic. We would say that's God, our creator, through Jesus Christ, his son. But whether you're talking about secular natural philosophy or Christian theology, they always believed in something, some foundational principle or being that really held everything together. And so natural philosophy intuitively recognized that there had to be something that provided for the harmonious display of nature, something that connected all the different parts. In other words, why is the natural world always so consistent? Why is it so measurable? Why is it so repeatable? Why is it going to be there tomorrow just like it was today? And for really the vast majority of the history of the world, they believed there was some principle or being underlying that explained how this all could be in this very consistent way. And so from a Christian perspective, natural theology understood that nature was really a book that was written by the one God and that it could only be properly understood through God's written book, the Bible. And so natural theology and written theology were viewed as being harmonious and as mutually interpretive. So the way to understand the natural world and natural philosophy is through God's word. And the way to better understand God's word is through his general revelation that he's given to us in creation. And so some of the early, what we would call scientists, were very devout Christians. People like Francis Bacon, 1500s, 1600s, he is credited with what we would now consider the scientific method. And he offered a genuinely Christian approach to nature. And he tried to eliminate some of the pagan roots of natural philosophy, such as from the Greek or the Roman natural philosophy. And he wanted to see it through a very specific Christian lens. So we can trace our scientific method that's still broadly used today back to a Christian named Francis Bacon. Robert Boyle, early 1600s to late 1600s, was one of the founders of modern chemistry. And he believed that science could not make progress if it was viewed through atheistic assumptions. He believed that God's providence is what accounted for the constancy and the regular and rapid motions of celestial bodies. So he didn't believe in any kind of just natural or by chance forces out there. He believed there was a personal, all-knowing, all-powerful God who was providentially upholding all of these things. And it was that foundation that motivated him to pursue science, because God's providence guaranteed consistency in his world. And that consistency in his world allowed him to pursue science and to make observations of things that would be there tomorrow, just like they are today. So for him, it gave a foundation to science. And we all know the name Isaac Newton, right? Isaac Newton, probably one of the most influential thinkers in Western civilization. And he recognized that his task was dependent on the character and activity of God. And for him, God, providence, and therefore theology was central to any proper understanding of science and nature. So you can see that some of the most influential people in studying nature or in developing scientific principles, they were believers. And they didn't see their faith in God and the learning of the natural world as in conflict. In fact, they saw the one supporting the other very much in harmony. And so the modern hostility or antipathy that we see between science and Christianity is really not normal in history. For the vast majority of human history, there's been a closer relationship between Christianity and science, or philosophy and science. And so science and Christianity are really meant to be compatible and to work together. There's nothing inherently contradictory between Christianity and science. The divide between science and Christianity really began to form during the Enlightenment. the Enlightenment period, really the core of the Enlightenment was a challenge to all authority, a challenge to external authorities. What the problem with that is when you challenge all authority, then the one challenging becomes the authority. So if you're challenging everything, then you become the authority. And this age of reason sought to ground all truth in individual thinking, individual reason. Truth could not come from religion or a creed, the Enlightenment said. They wanted to search for, quote unquote, the real truth. And they needed to throw off the shackles of religion in order to find that real truth, is what they were after. And so that was way back in the 1700s. And so now we've been breathing the air of this Enlightenment thinking for 300 years. Of it's all about reason. It's all about what we can perceive through our senses. It's what we as man can figure out on our own. And we don't need religion to tell us how to do that. And so its influence in our culture is profound, deep, and nearly universal. This battle between science and Christianity really began in earnest in America in the mid-19th century. So mid-1800s, we have someone by the name of John William Draper who wrote a book called The History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science, which really at that point was a pretty recent conflict. Then we have another man, pretty influential, Andrew Dixon White, A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. And by the way, both these books, you know, we've never heard of them before, most of us, but they're books that were incredibly well-known and popular in their day. Many of these went through multiple printings and translated into multiple languages. So very influential books. We've all heard of the next one, Charles Darwin and The Origin of Species. And he's probably the greatest influence on the divide between science and Christianity in the last 150 some years. In the history of science, Darwin's view is new, but it is not from the historical perspective normal. It kind of goes back to that statement of just because something is going on right now doesn't mean it's normal. And just because it's new doesn't mean that it's better. The norm in the history of science was to see nature as understandable only within the context of nature's God. But Darwin's view didn't need God. And so he was really very helpful to the Enlightenment. Those are some historical reasons. For the broad view of things, Christianity and science have been friends for a large part of history. Really, in the last 150 years or so, has been a really hostile environment developed between Christianity and science. So that is a reason. In the sense that just because something is now doesn't mean that that's the way it needs to be, or that's the way it has to be, or mean that it's necessarily better. So a broader perspective can help us. And then he talks about some foundational reasons. Darwin's views are not better because they're new. So just because Darwin comes up with something and it's new and everybody's jumping on the bandwagon doesn't mean that it's better or that it's right. The modern assumption of the separate and hostile spheres of religion and science is virtually universal. This is the current situation of things. Anywhere you look, it seems like there's this assumption that there's this battle going on between science and religion. And so the concept of an unguided process of species development and change is nearly universal in the realm of science today. Evolution, unguided by chance. Evolution of species. That's pretty much the assumption, such that you can have somebody like Richard Dawkins make this statement. It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims to not believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that. So if you're a Christian and you deny evolution, that's the opinion of the world about you. And that's pretty much the broad opinion of our culture today. And so to hold a Christian worldview and not believe in evolution is to invite the hatred or the pity of much of today's society, which leads to the question, how could someone not believe in evolution in the 21st century? If the whole world has gone this way, does that mean it's right? Not necessarily. Your mama taught you that, right? Just because everybody jumps off a bridge, that doesn't mean you should jump off one too. So just because a majority of people hold something doesn't mean that it's necessarily right. So why then should we believe in Christianity with all that we know about science in the 21st century? Well, here are some initial thoughts. First of all, the theory of evolution has gone through a number of changes and mutations since its ascendancy in the last 100 years. So when somebody talks about the theory of evolution, there's really no such thing. There are theories of evolution by different people, and they all have different views of how it goes and how it started, and they're all different. They don't all necessarily agree. So don't fall into the trap of thinking there's one harmonious theory of evolution that everybody's on the same page about. There are lots of different views within evolution. And the main reason that Darwin's theory caught on and developed is not because it was a completely new and previously never conceived theory. Ideas similar to that of Darwin's can be traced back to ancient Greece. So at least the basic ideas of Darwin of evolutionism wasn't entirely new. But the reason that Darwin's theories caught on and were so popular so quickly is because of they were planted in the soil of the Enlightenment. In other words, you had two things come together at the same time that were just perfectly conducive for each other, that helped each other spread and grow very fast, very quickly. And so evolution and the Enlightenment, they were goals that were mutually affirming. They had similar goals, similar purposes. And they acted like gasoline being poured on a small flame. The Enlightenment was intent on abolishing all external authority and finding answers by human reason alone. And with an evolutionary explanation for all things, the Enlightenment could now get rid of God once and for all. So basically you had these two, the Enlightenment was the ground, and then the soil was already prepared, and then evolution came along and it was planted in that fertile soil of like Miracle-Gro, and evolution was planted in that, and it grew and flourished quickly and caught on. So it was just like a perfect storm of things that came together in the 1800s that made it so popular so quickly. Basically, you had the Enlightenment philosophers were looking for a way to jettison God, which is why deism was so popular in the 1700s. Because in deism, they couldn't completely get rid of God, but at least in deism, they could put God on the shelf. And God was kind of out of the picture. So in deism, they couldn't completely ignore the existence of God. There was a God who created it, but then he just kind of let it go. And now it just operates according to these natural principles. So deism had a God, they couldn't get rid of him, but they kind of wanted to push him to the edge. But then Darwin came along and said, no, everything kind of developed naturally by chance. And the Enlightenment people said, oh, this is wonderful. Now we don't need God at all because we have this to explain things. And so it was like a perfect marriage between the Enlightenment philosophy and Darwin's views of science. But here's the problem with evolution is it suffers from a pretty significant flaw, and that is that it is intellectually incoherent, despite its near universal acceptance. And so he walks through in the chapter this incoherence, the way it doesn't make sense within itself. And I just kind of want to step by step walk through what he says in the chapter. Evolution believes that the universe is random and chance produced and only natural. So no supernatural allowed, right? And it's only made up of matter. There's no such thing as spiritual realm. So it's all random, it's all natural, and there's nothing spiritual about it at all. So here's the problem. Everything that we believe about this view is produced somehow by the material that makes up a human being. All of our beliefs are a product of the matter that composes our bodies. Which means then that if all of this is true, then how can we have any guarantee that our beliefs are true? In evolution, these beliefs might help us to adapt to our environment, and that's a good goal if you believe in evolution. But whether our beliefs are true or not cannot be determined simply through the material workings of our brains and bodies. Basically, here's what he's getting at, is if everything in the world is just a random by chance happening, then that includes even the firing of the synapses in our brain that work for us to believe that evolution is true. Which means that our beliefs about evolution are just as random as the rest of the universe, right? That's basically what he's getting at. And so if everything is random and everything is by chance, then what gives this belief in evolution any certainty at all? He says that evolution has no foundation. It's a theory that cannot make sense of itself. Really, belief in evolution is nothing more than a random collection of chemical reactions or bodily materials. He says it's no more special or unique than carbonated bubbles. I mean, if you believe that what's going on in our minds is only chemical reactions, right? Or the firing of electrical pulses, then what's different from that than your brain and a battery? Or your brain and a cup of soda? What's the difference? So there's really no foundation in evolution. It's a theory that cannot make sense of itself. And so this lack of a foundation, it's not just an academic thing. It's not just a philosophical thing. It goes to the heart of what is true and why it is true. In the chapter, he mentions that one time he was giving a lecture on a college campus about the Bible and about God's revelation in the world. And he said that a physicist who taught at the university came up to him afterward and said, "I'm an atheist." So he was an atheistic physicist teaching at the university. And he basically admitted to him, I have no reason to argue why the laws of physics are the way they are. I don't know why the laws of physics are the way they are. All I can do is teach the laws. And so he says, an atheistic physicist, he has no way to affirm or argue why the laws of physics are the way they are. He can only teach the laws. He has no way to guarantee that the laws that he's teaching are actually laws and that they will be there tomorrow and continue to run in a predictable pattern. He has no foundation to assume that. He doesn't know where these laws come from. So in order to approach the world in any kind of a predictable and stable way, we have to assume some organizing principle or being that makes it predictable and stable. Any theory that is based only on the natural and the material will never be able to make sense of the world, make sense of how it all fits together and runs the way that it does. In the history of science, the recognition of a unifying principle of nature found its true home in Christianity. It gives us a true starting point for a proper understanding of human life and all of nature, because we read in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So where did all this come from? God. God started it. God organized it. God is the unifying being. He is the one that holds it together. He is the one who guarantees that the sun will go down tonight and come up in the morning and do that every day after day after day. He's the one that set up the fact that we revolve around the sun every 365 and a quarter days. He's the one that sets this up and why there's that consistency in that pattern. So we have this unifying principle. It finds a home in Christianity. Given the relative novelty, the recentness of modern science, really, he suggests in the chapter, it would be more appropriate to ask, how could someone believe in modern science in the face of Christianity? And this is the thing about our current world and the skepticism of our current world is, don't let them take the higher ground. right? Don't let them assume the higher ground. Even the way that the question is posed, how could you believe in Christianity in the face of modern science? Well, they've got the higher ground in the way they ask that question, because they're assuming that modern science can't be challenged, that modern science has all the right answers. Well, flip it around on them. How can you believe in modern science in the face of Christianity? Where do your laws of physics come from? Where did the original matter that all this came from come from? Where was the original Big Bang? Where did that come from? How did that happen? If everything was exploding outward and floating outward in all this mass speed, then why are we still revolving around the sun exactly the same time every year after year after year and have been for centuries? So flip it around on them. Why believe in modern science in the face of Christianity? So the Enlightenment was not an argument that human beings were self-sufficient. It was a declaration that they wanted to be. They couldn't necessarily prove that they were self-sufficient. It's just their philosophy that they wanted to be. And so modern science really has done nothing to discredit the truths of Christianity. It has simply dismissed them as irrelevant. The rejection of Christianity is really more about self-autonomy than it is really about science. And unlike unguided evolution, belief in Christianity has a foundation. Belief in Christianity has something to stand on, and that foundation is in what God has said in his word and in his world. The heavens declare the glory of God. Science can flourish with a solid foundation in God's revelation. But without this foundation, the scientist has no place to stand. He's unable to produce the coherence needed for science to thrive. So then he finishes the chapter with, okay, how would a modern person, an atheistic person, someone who believes in modern science, what would they say to us? He says, one of the common responses has to do with the fossil record. Like, for example, well, if what you're saying is true and God created the world, then why does it look like all these fossils are millions and millions of years old? And we have all these different fossils that show changes and adaptation in species. How do you answer that? Well, Darwin himself recognized that the fossil record was actually an evidential argument against evolution. Darwin saw the fossil record and he thought, this is a hole that we don't have an answer for yet. So if evolution were true, then we should have an abundance of fossils of intermediate species, right? Not just changes within a species. So it's one thing to have some developments within a species as they adapt to their environment. It's quite another thing to have a cat go to a dog or a monkey go to a human being and to see no transitional forms, no fossils of transitional forms of those intermediate species anywhere in the fossil record. So it's one thing to have this kind of a tiger, and then later on in the record, it looks like this kind of a tiger. That's one thing. But it's quite another to see step by step by step fossils show where one species transforms into another. And we don't have it. So how do naturalist scientists respond to that? Well, one of the theories they came up with is what they called punctuated equilibrium, which is the idea that, yes, we have slow evolution, but then we also have a really rapid evolution that takes place and wasn't really enough time to leave a fossil record of that. Well, that's a nice theory and all, but there's really no evidence for it. Really, it's just a red herring solely designed because of the lack of fossil evidence of intermediate species, not because there's actually any evidence of rapid evolutionary change. But really, when you present them with, well, where are your intermediate species? They would say, well, there's punctuated equilibrium. And you could just say, well, that's just a what if. That's just a purely hypothetical. What if there was rapid evolutionary change? Well, yeah, what if? Show me some evidence that that it actually happened. So the evolutionary view of the fossil record assumes also a principle of uniformity. That is how they can date things millions and millions of years old. It assumes that everything has been happening at pretty much the same pace for all of time. And so they assume a principle of uniformity, that things have progressed relatively stable rates throughout time, but there's really no scientific evidence of this kind of uniformity. It's just assumed. Well, Scripture provides another explanation for how we could have fossils that look as old as they do. And one of them is the cataclysmic universal flood. Given the flood, we simply cannot assume a principle of uniformity in the formation of fossils and other evidence. So when you have something that huge, that incredibly world-changing, as the flood is described in Genesis, then you can't assume a uniformity going all the way back to the beginning of time. There's something that could have happened that could explain why we have these different fossils showing up the way that they do. So another argument against Christianity would be, well, don't Christians just assume their position while evolution is based on scientific evidence? And he says, remember the quote that we gave toward the beginning from C.S. Lewis. I believe Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. We believe in Christianity because we see it. We see it in God's world. We see it in Scripture. We see it in the church. We see it in our friends and ourselves. It is our whole life. And he also says that through Christianity, we see everything else and make sense of God's world. Christianity is a full worldview that can carry the weight of all of life's most important questions. So all the important questions that a person would ever ask, Christianity as a philosophy, as a theology, as a worldview can carry all of those questions. It can handle all of those questions. Evolution can't. Evolution is not an all-encompassing worldview. It doesn't have answers to the most important questions. And so evolution is not a comprehensive worldview. It can't even sufficiently account for its own theory. So evolution is random, unguided, and without moral or ethical content. Christianity provides the only sure foundation for scientific inquiry, and as well as the other huge questions of life.